Lecture 26, Segregation to Apartheid in South Africa.
Hello. If the history of the Congo, which we surveyed in the last lecture, seems to represent some of the great themes of 20th century African history in magnified form, in versions writ large, themes like colonial conquest, the realities of colonial rule, decolonization, and the disappointments of independence. In this lecture, we're going to turn to a different case altogether, a country whose history in the 20th century seems to run in a quite different trajectory. We know that even before the 20th century, South Africa's history was exceptional in Africa, especially in the very early establishment of substantial European, that is Dutch and British, settlement, and a subsequent frontier history quite reminiscent of that of the United States. We last touched South Africa at a stage where colonial conquest was complete. The country unified, and mining-based modernization well underway in a context of white supremacy. This was the beginnings of what we can call today the age of segregation. To move slightly forward, in the years following the Second World War, when the sun began to set on colonial rule in places like the French and British empires in Africa, and when the colonies of the French and the British, along with other parts of the world, like the United States, began to move with some seriousness towards an end to formalized white supremacy, the country of South Africa moved with great seriousness in the opposite direction. We can call this the transition from segregation to apartheid. It's a word from Afrikaans, literally meaning apartness. I'm sure that you've seen it and heard it many times, often pronounced apartheid or what have you, technically apartheid, but in any case, it was apartheid, of course, which made South Africa notorious and eventually something of an international pariah in the late 20th century. Now, let me turn back a bit and begin by offering what may be a rather different perspective on segregation, at least one that I think you may find stimulating. I will rely here largely on the work, in my view, brilliant work, of the late John Sell, and in particular his book entitled The Highest Stage of White Supremacy, The Origins of Segregation in South Africa and the American South. So a work of comparative history. Now, let me confess here to a certain personal bias. John Sell was my teacher at my undergraduate institution and the supervisor of my senior thesis, etc. He certainly remained my friend, teacher, and critic, and believe me, he could be a critic until his unfortunate and premature death in 2001. It turns out that I have a more direct connection with Sell, which I hope will also have some relevance here. I teach at North Carolina State University, and if you go two floors up in my building, I didn't know this until I took the job there, I can find, or you will find, a library which says the John W. Sell Library. Now, it is in fact not created in honor of the man I'm drawing on today, his work, but that of his father, who was a mathematics professor for 30 years or so at North Carolina State. Now, here's where I think this may have some relevance. My point is simply that Sell grew up in Raleigh, North Carolina. He grew up in the American South. He was a son of the South. He grew up during the age when segregation went from being very much in the saddle, of course, to being dismantled, certainly in the legal sense. He himself was a historian predominantly of British colonial administration, but he found himself, partly because of his own background, drawn to the subjects that I mentioned in the title of his book. Even as a young man, Sell was questioning things. He was a fine athlete, and at one point in the 1950s found himself playing for the high school basketball championship in North Carolina against a team, I have to mention this, which included Sonny Juergens. And the reason I have to mention is because I grew up in Northern Virginia, and I'm quite fond of the Washington football team. But even then, after they had lost to Juergensen's team, Sell was asking himself, at least in his reminiscences to me, why it was that the high school champions, so-called, of North Carolina were the winners, of course, of games played entirely by white North Carolina high school students. Okay. He wondered then about segregation because he grew up in it and because he had the kind of mind that wondered and was curious about a lot of things. He wondered, first of all, before he began this study, about the word itself. The word segregation does not appear in dictionaries, for instance, before approximately the first decade of the 20th century. And it is born, it's a new coinage, in other words. And that struck Sell as slightly curious. He wondered why it emerged not only at that time, but particularly, some would say almost exclusively, in two great places, in two particular places, in the American South and in the newly formed country of South Africa. Now, Sell had assumed, growing up and even later, assumed like I had assumed, like perhaps many of you had assumed, that segregation, what he called the highest stage of white supremacy, was the product of a rural past created by ignorant, backward people, if you like, that it was the legacy of left behind by slavery and by that frontier past, that it was the opposite of anything like progress, the opposite of progressive. Modernization, development, progress were fundamentally at odds with such irrationality, so the arguments seemed to him, and would gradually erode segregation. And indeed, these were the arguments made by liberals, if you will, in both South Africa and in the United States in the early to mid years of the 20th century. Now, his research and his reading, particularly his reading of a younger generation of South African historians beginning to publish their material in the very late 60s into the 70s and 80s, his research and reading led him in a quite different direction. Sell began to conclude that segregation was not, after all, just a throwback, a leftover from a frontier past, but rather a response, indeed an innovative, even creative response, to conditions of turbulent social, economic, and political change. Spurred in both cases, in both the South African case and the Southern American case, by the onset of substantial urbanization and industrialization. Now, again, I don't want to suggest that Sell overstated this. He states quite clearly in the first pages of the book that it was the ideology of white supremacy, of white racism, if you like, which was the driving force of segregation. But he wondered why it didn't result in other kinds of alternatives that might have been entertained after the ending of slavery, for instance, such as deportation. At one point, he even wondered about genocide. And when his editors, he told me, questioned the you know, that this was really not something remotely conceivable in the case of the U.S. Case, for instance, he had an answer, I think, born from the 20th century. And that was, how many did Hitler kill? In other words, segregation represented one path which white supremacy might take, and it was his association or his discovery that it seems to emerge and be identified not so much with these cultural atavisms, with these throwbacks, these leftovers, but rather with the emergence of cities, the emergence of factories, with modern infrastructure, even with progressive politics in many cases. Segregation, then, he concluded, represented, in a nutshell, the modernization of white supremacy. Racial discrimination was not necessarily incompatible. It was not necessarily an irrationality that would be eroded by economic development. Not incompatible with that. Indeed, it might actually contribute to economic growth and development. And this was an idea that he definitely did take from the South African scholars I mentioned a moment ago. For instance, through the creation of an inexpensive supply of labor as a factor fueling economic growth and development at the macro level. Now, segregation, of course, often taken to be separation. Again, he asked himself, and I ask you to ask yourselves, why it is that there was the coinage of a different word then, if it was simply separation. Now, don't get me wrong or get Sell wrong. There was obviously separation in many and numerous spheres. There was clearly separation in legal ownership of land, in residential life, in education, and so on. But his argument is that, again, at the macro level, in the overall view of these societies in the stages of history that they were going through, that these societies were actually being knit together more closely than they had been in the past, that they were becoming more, not less, intertwined, that there were greater levels of mutual dependency, particularly in South Africa, perhaps, with its dependence on labor, than had been the case in the past. More intertwined, more, if I can use the word, more integrated, if you like. But integrated unequally. He asks us to think of segregation, then, as unequal integration. And at one point he puts it this way, if the groups that compose society, these societies, were truly separate, if they really lived their lives apart, if economy and society were truly plural or dual, there would be no need for segregation. Now, in the South African case, the racial pillars of the segregated society, a society, again, in the aftermath of the discoveries of gold and diamonds, a society is increasingly driven by an urban industrial dynamic. The racial pillars were, I would suggest, three. There were a radically unequal division of land, yes, and that is a form of separation. But what flows from that? The second pillar is a resultant low-wage migrant labor system, which we examined in lecture number 18. The necessity for oscillating migrancy out of the limited amounts of space and land reserved under the segregation division of land, the land laws in South Africa of 1913 and 1936, for instance, the resultant cheap labor migrancy system is a direct consequence of that division of land. The third pillar, of course, is a white monopoly on political power. Again, in the Constitution of 1910, although in a couple of exceptional cases, in the old Cape Colony, now part of this unified country, they still had a colorblind franchise. That was not the case in the other provinces of South Africa, except very theoretically in Natal. In the Orange Free State and in the Transvaal, there's a straightforward racial exclusion on voting. Even if you could vote for members of parliament, let's say, and you were an African or a so-called colored, and a few could for a number of years still, based on income, education, and so forth, you could vote only for white candidates. Again, by law in that 1910 constitution, all members of parliament were required to be white. So three pillars of segregation, the unequal division of land, the migrant labor system, and the white monopoly on political power. Now, if that's the case of segregation, or if that is a capsule characterization of segregation, what then is the significance of the move from segregation to apartheid? The shift is usually marked with the South African election of 1948, which brought the so-called purified Afrikaner Nationalist Party to power and marks the onset of apartheid as the official policy of the Union of South Africa. It is common to refer to that election of 1948 and to that year of 1948 in many analyses I have heard and read as a watershed in South African history. I do not accept the watershed metaphor. After all, the watershed metaphor is based on the assertion that the water, if you like, that is events, ideas, the tide of history, trends, you know, call it what you like, that the water in those senses is running in a fundamentally different direction on one side of the divide compared to the other. It's obviously an image drawn from geography and ridges and watersheds and so forth. So again, the notion of a watershed, that the tide of history, events, ideas running in fundamentally one direction on one side of the watershed event or year or marker, running in a fundamentally different way on the other. But I would argue that the trend in South Africa after 1948 was not fundamentally different from before that time. The pillars of apartheid, the land, labor, and power features I just mentioned, were the same pillars of segregation and had been solidly erected in the segregation era. I would like to try to demonstrate that by going back to the segregation era to a speech by Jan Christian Smuts, who was the loser in the 1948 election. That is, he lost to those who were interested in imposing apartheid. But this is a speech that Smuts made long, long ago. Smuts had a very long and distinguished career. He first made a name fighting the British in the Boer War back in 1899 to 1902, went on to become a distinguished philosopher of science and eventually a world statesman. This is from a speech he made in 1917 in London while on a visit there. And he outlined the future South Africa towards which they were working. His words: "You will have large areas cultivated by blacks and governed by blacks, where they will look after themselves and all their forms of living and development, while in the rest of the country you will have your white communities, which will govern themselves separately according to the accepted European principles. The natives will, of course, be free to go and work in the white areas, but as far as possible, the administration in white and black areas will be separated such that each will be satisfied and developed according to its own proper lines." And this notion of the development along your own lines is very typical of the language of segregation. But, of course, the crucial sentence there is the natives will, of course, be free to go and work in the white areas. By the million, these were societies that were becoming more interdependent, more intertwined, and again at the macro level, integrated, though obviously unequally. Sell commented that not even Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd, who was considered the great theorist of apartheid in the 1950s and 60s, really improved upon General Smuts's formulation. So I think that the pillars are there. We can ask then, what is the significance of 1948? I would say that what was different was the deadly serious effort by South Africa's new rulers to intensify every form of racial discrimination, but more important, in my view, most important, to make white supremacy permanent. This was a project to seal off the future, as it were, to craft a final solution. Now, I'm aware of the gravity of that term, final solution, and I'm obviously not discussing genocide here. Again, that's not the name of the game here under segregation or apartheid in anything like the literal sense, precisely because of the mutual dependency. But I do mean it was intended to seal off the future, to create a final bearing, a final parameters, a set of final parameters, if you like, in which South African life and history would go forward. Now, to these ends, the National Party government passed an avalanche of new legislation in the 1950s designed to regulate every aspect of race relations. Miscegenation and intermarriage were outlawed. There was to be total separation of every form of public amenity and in urban residential areas. So this is the era when the park benches begin to be painted over, or the signs pointing people to toilets, or the water fountains, let alone the buses and restaurants, et cetera, with, you know, literally whites only, blancs only in Afrikaans, or nie blancs, non-whites only, Bantu, colored, and Asian only. This is the apartheid of the signs. That is what some analysts call petty apartheid. Not that it's unimportant, although its importance is less than what I'll call grand apartheid in a moment. In the education sphere, so-called Bantu education under the new rulers in the 1950s emasculated the mission-based but quite open-ended, that is, no ceiling for the rise of black students under those mission-based systems, emasculated that schooling available to blacks and imposed what one critic, Trevor Huddleston, the Anglican bishop there in the 1950s, called education for servitude. Under Prime Ministers Verwoerd, who served from 1958 to 1966, when he was assassinated, actually, dramatically, by a stabbing in Parliament by a deranged white, seemed to have very little to do with his politics. The great theorist, under Verwoerd and under his successor, J.B. Forster, who ruled from 66 to 78, the government pursued its vision of grand apartheid. Each of South Africa's 10 major Bantu ethnic groups, or tribes, if you like, the Zulu, the Xhosa, the Venda, Ndebele, etc., etc., would ultimately find its political destiny in its own homeland. That is, its portion of the land originally set aside as reserves for blacks in the land laws of 1913 and 1936. The terminology here went from reserves to so-called Bantustans and ultimately to homelands. And again, you can hear the echoes there from Smuts's formulation much, much earlier of the ultimate political destiny being devolved away from South Africa proper into these homelands. Indeed, four of the homelands eventually were declared to be independent by the South African government. No other country in the world recognized them. But they literally, South Africans literally lost their citizenship, including millions of people who had never actually seen the homelands because they and their parents and grandparents had lived in the cities. This was divide and rule with a vengeance. Again, I repeat, there was to be no common political future. Since all 10 homelands combined constituted only 13% of South Africa's total land area, designed in theory to accommodate 75% of the population, there was in fact no actual possibility that all of the tribes people, so-called, assigned to a given homeland could actually make a living there. They would need to continue to migrate and work in so-called white South Africa. The architects of apartheid, therefore, never entertained the notion of ending their dependence on black labor. This was not true total separation, but an elaboration on continued unequal integration. Now, needless to say, South Africa's non-white population, the so-called blacks, so-called coloreds, and Asians, did not take all of this lying down. A new generation of black activists coming of age in the 1940s and 1950s injected a new strain of militance, and understandably, as apartheid set in, a new tone of urgency to protests in the name of equality. Within the African National Congress, which had been founded way back in 1912 and was part of that first generation of petitioning elite style of protest, within the ANC, this change was symbolized by the mass party but nonviolent vision of the Youth League and of one of its founders. And at this point, I'd like to quote Mandela, speaking of this point of his life when he became politicized at some length. And this is from his autobiography. He says, "I cannot pinpoint a moment when I became politicized, when I knew that I would spend my life in the liberation struggle. To be an African in South Africa means that one is politicized from the moment of one's birth, whether one acknowledges it or not. An African child is born in an African's only hospital, taken home in an African's only bus, lives in an African's only area, and attends African's only schools if he attends schools at all. When he grows up, he can hold African's only jobs, rent a house in African's only townships, ride African's only trains, and be stopped at any time of the day or night and be ordered to produce a pass, failing which he will be arrested and thrown in jail. His life is circumscribed by racist laws and regulations that cripple his growth, dim his potential, and stunt his life. This was the reality, and one could deal with it in myriad ways. I had no epiphany, no singular revelation, no moment of truth, but a steady accumulation of 1,000 slights, 1,000 indignities, 1,000 unremembered moments produced in me an anger, a rebelliousness, a desire to fight the system that imprisoned my people. There was no particular day on which I said, 'From henceforth I will devote myself to the liberation of my people.' Instead, I simply found myself doing so and could not do otherwise." Throughout the 1950s, these activists constantly escalated their own campaigns in response to the government measures. They had names like the Program of Action, the Defiance Campaign. In 1955, the ANC and allied organizations adopted the Freedom Charter, a virtual constitution for a future non-racial, egalitarian South Africa. The dialectic going on here of move and counter-move, government moves, protesters' response, opposition moves, government response, and so on. This dialectic reached a climax at a place called Sharpeville, south of Johannesburg in 1960, where police opened fire on unarmed protesters of the hated pass laws. This was the identity booklet that all South Africans had to carry, giving them the right to be in a city, for instance, or not, opened fire and shot 69 dead, many of them in the back. In the aftermath, the government took all gloves off, banning the ANC and many other movements, the PAC, the Communist Party, and so on, and moved with a great deal of firmness towards tactics they had not utilized before, detention without trial, the increasing use of interrogation involving torture, and so on. For their part, Mandela and his peers concluded that they had closed a chapter on the question of nonviolence. And indeed, I'll turn again to his own explanation of this. He said they'd, quote, "come to the conclusion that as violence in this country was inevitable, it would be unrealistic and wrong for African leaders to continue preaching peace and nonviolence at a time when the government met our peaceful demands with force. This conclusion was not easily arrived at. It was only when all else had failed, when all channels of peaceful protest had been barred to us, that the decision was made to embark on violent forms of political struggle and to form Umkhonto weSizwe." Now, Umkhonto weSizwe means the spear of the nation, MK for short in its abbreviations. Umkhonto weSizwe became the military arm, the military wing, if you like, of the ANC from the early 60s on, and this obviously represented a very sharp turn indeed for that historic organization. There was now then a very thoroughgoing polarization in South Africa. The notion that nonviolent or constitutional or peaceful avenues of protest might get anywhere seemed to have reached a dead end. Again, both sides shift their tactics and their strategies quite dramatically at this turning point around 1960 or so. Again, compare that to what's going on in so much else of Africa to the north around 1960 or so. Polarization. After some initial successes in a sabotage campaign, Mandela and other top leaders were caught, tried for treason, and sentenced to life in 1964. And again, I'll just quote him one more time, his statement at the time of his sentencing. "During my lifetime, I have dedicated myself to this struggle of the African people. I have fought against white domination. I have fought against black domination. I have cherished the ideal of a democratic and free society in which all persons live together in harmony and with equal opportunities. It is an ideal which I hope to live for and to achieve. but if needs be, it is an ideal for which I am prepared to die. And in fact, it was very possible that he and his fellow ANC members on trial could have been sentenced to death. Well, with the imprisonment of Mandela and others, with the banning of the ANC and so on, white supremacy seemed securely in the saddle. Indeed, in the rest of the 1960s and 70s, things were eerily quiet. I started this with a comparison between the United States and South Africa, but if you compare them in the late 60s and early 70s, they're completely different. There's this the era of a very strident protest, for instance, in the U.S., and very little upfront in South Africa. Economically, South Africa prospered as never before, demonstrating again, perhaps, that racial oppression could be quite compatible with economic growth and one form of development. Thank you.